What is real? How do you define real?
You can't jump into cash. Cash is trash. What do? You get out.
David Bailey is the CEO of BTC Inc., an ecosystem of companies building the open economy and empowering creators to reorganize the world. He is also the CEO of Bitcoin Magazine, which is hosting Bitcoin 2021 in Miami, the largest Bitcoin event in history, on June 4th and 5th of this year. He is an eternal optimist, builder, backer, vagrant, evangelist, and nerd who is on a mission to make Bitcoin fun again. David Bailey, welcome to the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. How are you?
Good. Thanks for having me, Cedric.
Yeah, man. I'm so excited to have you here. I'm also excited for Bitcoin 2021. It's going to be my first conference in person. I'm going with my wife. Very excited to go. But I kind of want to hear a lot about, you know, the prior conferences so we can get an idea of what happens at these conferences and how exciting they could be.
Yeah. So, I mean, exciting depends on who you are. I mean, I think Bitcoiners maybe have a different definition of exciting than maybe other people do. But yeah, we brought the Bitcoin conference back in Bitcoin in 2019, really as an ode to the early Bitcoin scene when it was much more movement driven, much more philosophical, ideological. You know, everyone was broke, so it made it a lot simpler from that perspective. The community wasn't fractured over hard forks or wasn't fractured over, you know, shit coins. It was a kind of like a pure time to be involved in Bitcoin. And we were just talking about this before hopping on, but, you know, kind of the inflection point where I decided to jump full time into Bitcoin and go from just a holder to, you know, a builder in the space was after attending Bitcoin 2013. And, you know, before going to the conference, it was hard to determine how real this was from the standpoint of like people organized via forums. You know, if you've spent much time on Bitcoin talk, you know, it's a shit show. So it's like, is this real or is this just a bunch of people with too much time on their hands on the internet? You know, I met the smartest people I had ever met at that conference. Yeah. And so many ideologically motivated people that were working relentlessly around the clock for free to make this reality. And when you see bright people who share a passion for the potential of a technology, that is such a signal that there's something real there. And so, you know, being at the conference, I mean, you know, I think after the first day or second day, the conference as a group went to watch a new Star Trek movie that had come out. So, I mean, like, talk about nerdy. And then, you know, we get done with the Star Trek movie. We come back. It's midnight. And, you know, the hotel lobby is just stuffed full of people broken out in groups of three or four people talking about different business ideas and companies they want to launch. And, hey, we should start an exchange in China. Or, hey, we should start, a wallet doing this. And, I mean, I don't even know how many businesses formed out of just people meeting in the middle of the night in the lobby of that hotel. And so, you know, when you feel the energy, it makes it so real and it makes it, it's exciting. I mean, you just feel the energy. And so, you know, we wanted to bring that back, and especially before 2019, dude, we had just come off this super contentious hard fork. And, you know, there's a point in time where every civil war is fought, and a winner, it happens, and then like the war is over, you know. And there was a certain point in time where like the hard fork civil war just became like, you know, a former war, and it's over. And so it got so ugly. We wanted to bring people back, and you mentioned from my Twitter bio, make Bitcoin fun again. It's just like when people are having fun and when they're zoomed in on the potential and on the future, great things happen. And when they get all caught up on the past and they get caught up on, you know, you said this on Twitter or it's just a distraction. It's like, why are we here? What's the point of all of this? And like we are on a mission for hyper Bitcoinization. Like, we are here to free humanity from the monetary system that we are enslaved by. And so like the world needs Bitcoin. It doesn't have time for us to be petty on Twitter, upset about, hey, well, your company supported this thing or that thing. Like, people can be wrong, get over it. And then like, let's build the best Bitcoin we possibly can. So Bitcoin 2019, I think we did a fantastic job. We had about 2000 people. It felt very Bitcoin OG. So like, that's what we're trying to do at Bitcoin 2021. Unfortunately, we had to pause Bitcoin 2020 because of the pandemic. And it's challenging to keep the vibes as the event scales up. So, I mean, number one thing that's keeping me up at night is we have so many people coming to this thing. It's like, can we enforce, you know, the same focus that we had at Bitcoin 2019 when we have 6 times more people or 7 times more people attending? And I hope so. And we're trying really hard, but this is our first time doing an event of this size. So, you know, YOLO, we'll see.
Yeah, I can see that. I'm trying to be not focused when I go to 2021 and allow myself to go wherever the breakout session is, and to not be consumed by a schedule or anything that is sort of, I just want to enjoy being there.
Totally. I guess I mean focused on Bitcoin. Like,
right.
You know, this is taking on like a bigger thing. I mean, I'm not going to say it's spiraling out of control because we have it under control, but I mean, at this point in time, every day we're hearing from A-list celebrities, household names that are trying to get tickets to the conference. Like, it's now become like a flagship for, I think, a lot of the crypto ecosystem. And like, we're having to be very diligent in reminding people, like, this is a Bitcoin conference. Like, we're here to focus on Bitcoin.
Right.
We're a Bitcoin only conference, which is different than a Bitcoin maximalist conference, because it's not like we're here to like hate on other things. We just don't care. It's outside of the scope of what matters for this event. So, but while you're at this event, it's Bitcoin only. And like, that's where the conversation has to stay focused. And I'm going to be really pissed if people don't take that sincerely. And, you know, it's actually like, we're trying to remind people so often so that we can keep that vibe, that it's kind of making some people mad. And I actually think there's a conference that's gotten started that's going to happen about 3 blocks away called Shitcoin 2021. For people, sponsors that we turn down that are upset, we turn them down, and you know, but at least they could call themselves the shit coins and do it. Right. Good, you know, have a good laugh about it.
Yeah. Sounds like the nature of this new ecosystem, for humanity. And there's always going to be some spillover, and sounds like it's great that they have their own conference. Cause I know I'll be very focused on Bitcoin while I'm there. I'm so excited.
Well, it's an interesting like challenge I think every community has or culture has, where as a culture goes mainstream, like, you know, it starts to get watered down. And so the battle is like, you know, in our opinion, culture is really information at scale. Like, for example, HODL, you know, the word. I mean, there is such a immense amount of information compressed into a 4-letter word, you know, and like there, you write a textbook about why HODL makes sense, why that's such an important part of being a Bitcoiner. Or you could skip all of that and just know HODL and you got it, you know, you got the kind of the key cliff notes. And so, you know, HODL is such a more consumable form of information for the masses of the world than the textbook that's behind it.
Right.
And so, you know, our challenge, like we built this event because, you know, not only to make Bitcoin fun, but we want to showcase the Bitcoin counterculture and we want to export it. We want people to be like, wow, this is awesome. You know, I understand these ideas and I'm going to go home and I'm going to evangelize these ideas to the people that I know. I mean, culture, the Bitcoin counterculture is super cool. It's what we want to make mainstream, but then we got to battle the mainstream to not let them, you know, water down what it means to be a Bitcoiner.
Right. Yeah. I remember watching, I saw pictures from 2019. I was very jealous. It looked very OG. It looked like, you know, things were being sparked. But I clearly, you know, whenever I came across the 2013 video of Eric Voorhees speaking, and that speech blew my mind. It's really one of the seminal pieces for me in sort of my conviction. And what really kind of just blows me away, though, is that it was 2013. So I didn't come across it for 5-6 years. And I can't imagine what it was like to be in that room. One, if that speech changed me seeing it online. So I'm wondering, like, what was it like going into that conference for you? Where were you at with Bitcoin? And how'd you end up spending time at a Bitcoin conference?
Yeah, so I mean, before it was
the popular cool thing to do, like in my
and Eric Voorhees, like, he is just legendary status in terms of the incredible things that he's done for Bitcoin, with Bitcoin. A lot of people like to hate on him on Twitter, like, oh, shapeshift, yada, but like, he's done so many cool things over the past decade and is such a just articulate advocate for freedom. I love Eric Voorhees, and he has a great blog for those listening. I think it's called Sovereign. I'm blanking on it, but he has a great blog. Google it. I highly recommend reading his stuff. I got into Bitcoin in late 2012. I got very lucky on my timing. I bought my first Bitcoins, I think, in November of 2012. I had found out about Bitcoin a couple months earlier. I had thought it was a scam at first. I tried to dive in to kind of prove it was a scam. It's not a scam. So that's when I decided to buy my first Bitcoins. In January, the Bitcoin bull run, my first bubble kind of got kicked off, and we went from $13 a Bitcoin to $260 a Bitcoin, all the way down to $50 a Bitcoin when it crashed and corrected. I'm a college student. At this time, I think I'm going to go into investment banking. I put $10,000 or whatever into Bitcoin. And going through that first bubble, I mean, I had made and then I lost more money than I had ever seen in my life at that point in time. And so that's a pretty emotional experience. And, you feel like a genius on the way up and you feel like an idiot on the way down. And the crash happened in April. And so it's at a kind of a crux in my very tiny, limited career at that point in time, where it's like, okay, am I going to go to the real world? Or am I going to pursue this radical thing that has completely consumed my attention and I'm dreaming about at night? Everyone I knew, every personal relationship I knew told me, you are absolutely insane to go pursue Bitcoin. That's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. And so the conference, Bitcoin 2013, happened in May, a month later. And so that was going to be like where I decided. And that's why it was like kind of so impactful that it was there and in that part of my journey. A funny story, like on Bitcoin Talks, I actually organized a meetup at the conference for just, degenerates on the Bitcoin Talk forums to see who would show up. And there was four people that showed up to the first meetup the first night. All four of them, I'm still to this day close friends with. Two of them made it to my wedding, the four, Andreas Antonopoulos was one of them, but at this point in time, no one knew who Andreas was. George Papagiorgio, who runs the digital currency masters now at Nicola University in Cyprus. Adam Perlow, who's an entrepreneur in the space from Israel, and Seth Otterstadt, who's a professional poker player, massive nerd. He'd say he's not a nerd, but he's a massive nerd. And runs a hedge fund now. So all four of these guys, I'm just a redneck from Alabama coming to my first real business conference in San Francisco, San Jose. And it's like a professional poker player, a Greek exile, a Cypriotic, entrepreneur, Israeli, former Israeli soldier. I mean, it's like, what a weird fusion of people. And it's one of the most, probably the coolest thing about Bitcoin is like, because it's a set of ideas, it's a flag that is raised that draws people to those ideas. It has like a self-selection bias. And so people around the world, from any background, from any country, from any language, from any ethnicity, they're attracted to Bitcoin for the same reasons. And so they share a commonality amongst each other that make you just kind of naturally click together, even though you have completely different backgrounds. And so, yeah, I mean, very impressionable on me, especially as I think at the time I was 21 years old, or maybe had just turned 22.
Yeah. I think through Bitcoin, I've relearned patience. And almost inversely, by watching a video like in that 2013 conference, I became impatient. You learn an idea, you gain conviction, and you just want it to be spread immediately. You want it to happen now. You've recognized it. Do you think being around for what is now maybe 8 years, 9 years, I don't know the math, but having seen certain the cycles the way they've been, and maybe even studying finance pre-Bitcoin and seeing cycles, do you think you've become more tempered because of your experience going through these cycles? Or do you maybe have the same impatience as everyone else? Or I don't want to, not that everyone's impatient, but and we're all trying to be low time preference. And I think I've gotten there.
Yeah. So I mean, absolutely. I mean, absolutely. Like, you know, I've made almost every mistake you can possibly make. You know, there's a great quote out there. Being Bitcoin OG, it's not about how much Bitcoin you have, it's about how much Bitcoin you've lost. And, you know, every piece of naivety and hope that I had for every kind of fringe idea, an altcoin, another protocol, a token, a blockchain, whatever, has been crushed out of me as I've seen good intention after good intention after good intention fail. You know, I've made and lost and made and re-lost fortunes. You know, I mean, by the time I was 26 or 27, I had made hundreds of millions of dollars and lost hundreds of millions of dollars in back-to-back years. You know, I've scaled a business up to 110 people, and then I've had to lay off 85% of that company in order to survive. These are very emotional, challenging situations that really force you to figure out who you are and what you're about and why you do what you do, because any sane person, when it's not worth it, it's not worth all the pain, it's not worth all the sacrifice in order to do what? Like, why are you here? And, you know, for me, it really took kind of a dramatic experience of losing a lot of money and having to go through that kind of just period of self-reflection and be, you know, I'm here for hyper-Bitcoinization. I mean, I'm here to replace the monetary system with one that's open and free for the world. You know, I'm here to see human society be able to evolve and for humanity to level up through the Kardashev scale. You know, like that's my calling. And so, you know, I feel like I have more urgency than ever to make that happen. But I've also, like, watching this ecosystem grow from nothing, or from basically nothing, to where it is now, it, like, this is going to happen with or without us. It's going to happen with or without me. I realize no one matters in this thing. This is an emergent system that fuels itself. But that doesn't mean I don't want to be a part of it, and I don't want to urgently spread it as quickly as possible to every person on the world. And every day that we delay is a day of suffering that someone, you know, unknowingly has to live through, dealing with their corrupt or broken or excluded financial system or monetary system. And it's not so much the pain people deal with today, though that sucks, but it's the opportunity cost of what could be that's not. And so, you know, it's definitely my time preference has changed. Like, this go around for, you know, ever since we decided to go Bitcoin only. So our business now, you know, in 2018, we divested everything that wasn't Bitcoin only. And, you know, we've never been happier than from doing that decision. It's the best strategic move we've ever made as a company. You know, last time around, it was all, when I was a younger man, it was all about grow, because we want investors and we want VC and we want, you know, all the wrong reasons basically to be doing it. And now it's like, hey, we want to catalyze movement. We have a mission. We have the rest of our lives to see it happen. Like, you know, fuck investors, fuck venture capital, you know, fuck growing to try to grow just to impress someone else. Who cares what they think? Like, let's build a solid, you know, profitable business that makes a great product that does exactly what we want it to do and that we have a shit ton of fun doing it. And if we have a lot of fun doing it, then we can do it all day, every day, 365, 24/7. And so that's our new mentality. And it's worked incredibly well for us. And it's like, there are, you know, opportunities that, you know, in the past would have distracted us and that we're excited by and we want to do, but now, like, we have no problem being like, that's the next bubble thing. So, like, we'll get that in the next 4-year cycle. And, you know, the 4-year cycle is definitely a feature and not a bug of the Bitcoin system, because it really allows both the hyper growth, but also the necessary evil of wiping out the bullshit, wiping out the malinvestment, wiping out the non-productive assets, and reallocating the people and the talent and the information more efficiently to the people who have businesses and products that the market actually wants, that has product market fit. So, you know, it's almost like a forest fire. You know, you need a brush fire to come through every so often in order to help maintain the healthiness of an ecosystem over a long period of time. So yeah, that's a long-winded answer. Great. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I loved it. How do you guys think through sharing this ethos or this mission with your readership and audience, and sort of where to choose what areas to cover?
So, you know, for us, the biggest challenge that we've had is really just execution. So, I mean, there's so much green pasture and our team has been small. I mean, fortunately, we've been able to grow and add more talent to the team, which has added more options, but really it's just like, how do we do the basics? So, you know, that's hard enough to do the basics. You run a podcast, you know how much time goes into just producing a single episode, queuing everything up. So, you know, let's just do the basics. From there, we try to think about, you know, the news of the moment doesn't really matter. The news is noise. What we want to do is give signal that actually advances the Bitcoin cause from the standpoint of inspiring people with new ideas, showing them what can be done that they didn't know about formerly. Like, we want people to read an article of ours and be like, wow, I could use that with this thing. Or we want them to read an article and be like, that's a dumb idea, I could do that idea better. And, you know, those things advance the conversation. Whereas, you know, X company accepts Bitcoin, or, you know, Jamie Dimon says this, those things just don't matter. And so, you know, we really try to push ourselves to create content that expands the boundary, the intellectual boundary of Bitcoin. And so we want to talk about, what does hyper-Bitcoinization look like? We want to talk about the Cantillon effect, you know, 100 years from now. We want to talk about, you know, we've been doing some great coverage of the industrial revolution that's coming due to investment into Bitcoin mining. You know, we want to talk about the circular economy. I mean, we want to talk about the cultural moments of, you know, pay me in Bitcoin, individual sovereignty, individual freedom, you know, so the more radical we can be, like, fortunately, because of just the nature of being Bitcoin only, it gives us like free reign to be as radical as possible. So that's kind of what we're drilling into.
Yeah. How did you come to Bitcoin Magazine? And what has it been like learning pretty much as a CEO on the job from the get-go? Or maybe I'm making an assumption there.
No. Yeah. No. So actually I interviewed to be employee number one at Coinbase. They only had money to hire one person, at least that's what they told me. And they hired this guy, Olaf. And so I was kind of like, well, fuck this, I'm gonna start my own company. And so that's how I got started with the business. I started with something called Why Bitcoin, which was a print magazine. And again, only a print magazine because I was clueless about, you know, cost structures, margins, I would never start a print magazine to start now. But at the time, it actually kind of by accident worked out because there was like a credibility problem that Bitcoin had. And so something that was physical and in paper demonstrated a level of credibility that I think normal people that would never go on the Bitcoin talk forums felt more comfortable with. And if you told someone that you owned Bitcoin, they'd have the same questions like, what is Bitcoin? Why would I want that? Why does it have value? Where can I spend it? What can I do with it? What's Bitcoin mining? How do I store it? Like the same questions again and again and again. Like literally you know, I probably answered those questions 1,000 times. And so it was like, okay, if we could just make a magazine that answered in the most succinct format possible each of those questions, then when someone asks you about Bitcoin, you just give them a magazine and it's, you know, the magazine was called Why Bitcoin. So that's where we started. It was a totally free magazine. It was sponsor supported. And we just grinded away at growing it, scaling it, getting sponsors behind it. And there was really only one other media publication at the time in the game called Bitcoin Magazine. And they had fantastic content. I mean, they were like the titan of the space when I was getting involved, but they never had good operations. They never had good, you know, a sales engine. They were never good at kind of monetizing and building a sustainable business, which is hard. I mean, I'm not knocking them. It's really hard in the media space. So when Vitalik and Mihai wanted to go launch a project that later became known as Ethereum, I bought Bitcoin Magazine so that they could go on to newer and greater things. And so I basically didn't have the money to buy it, but I scrapped it together. I got them to break up the payments over time. We did everything we could to make it work. And so we've owned Bitcoin Magazine since 2014, and we've always considered it like the Vatican, the canon, the crown jewels, like an institution that has to be like protected at all costs. We're very honored to be the custodians of Bitcoin Magazine, and it, you know, eventually I'll die one day and somebody else will be the owner of it. And it, you know, there's content that Bitcoin Magazine covered that no one else in the world covered. I mean, stories from the very early days of Bitcoin, of major hacks, of the first lawsuits, of the first time the word multi-sig that I can find on the web gets mentioned, the first, you know, really innovative stuff. And we're very honored to be able to like house what we kind of feel like is canon content of the Church of Satoshi.
What kind of really excites you right now in terms of something going on in the Bitcoin space that like really is interesting to you at the moment?
Well, there's a lot of things. I'd say the one that I think is, you know, I've been noticing the most that I think can have a cultural moment here is the pay me in Bitcoin. Russell Okung, I think, is really who championed that initially. But we keep hearing that phrase again and again and again from athletes that we're talking to, musicians that we're talking to. There's kind of this. It for those that are on the edge of culture, it's a cool thing to be able to say, I want financial empowerment. I want to control my own money and I don't want to have to use a corrupt bank to do it. And I want you to pay me in Bitcoin. And that's powerful. And if we can get 1 million people or 10 million people around the world to demand to be paid in Bitcoin, we will accelerate hyper-Bitcoinization by 20 years. So that's one thing I think is really cool. And it's, you know, we have a whole panel at the conference on pay me in Bitcoin. We have a rapper on it, Money Man, who's getting paid in Bitcoin. We have the CEO of Empire Records, which is, I think, one of the biggest music labels in the world, talking about paying artists in Bitcoin. I see a cultural moment developing there. So that's one thing I think is really cool. You know, the other thing that I'm like very focused on is the hyper-Bitcoinization topic in general. I think a lot of people are very focused on short-term milestones of like, a Bitcoin equals 250,000 or a Bitcoin is $1 million or how do we get to this or that? And I think at the end of this cycle, this bull market, we're going to get to a certain point in the narrative where it's hard to justify why the price of Bitcoin is as high as it is, and hard to justify why in a couple of years time, there's going to be another 100X cycle. And then a few years after that, another 100X cycle. it breaks all of the narratives that people have historically used. And I think the only narrative that is going to be left to talk about for why this phenomenon is occurring in front of everyone is the hyper-Bitcoinization one. 100% adoption, 100% penetration, one Bitcoin equals 121 millionth of all the things, and the death of the fiat system. And it's not a super credible thing to say to a room full of bankers or CEOs or whatever, and that's why people don't talk about it. But it's going to be the only thing you can really talk about once we move past all of the other, you know, models that people use to talk about it breaking. So I feel like that's one of the most, you know, it's almost like the Bitcoin game doesn't even start until one Bitcoin equals 121 millionth of all the things. Like when there's 100% adoption, that's the beginning of the system. And right now we're just watching the process to get to the beginning. And so I feel like there's such a massive amount of unexplored intellectual land there that people are just now starting to get serious about exploring. And we're going to have a lot of awesome hyper-Bitcoinization content at the conference, Bitcoin in space content, Bitcoin in stacks content, that really talks about where's Bitcoin going to be 20 years, 40 years, 100 years from now, which, you know, I mean, that's like we're building something that's going to transform society for millennium. You know, like what happens in the first 10 years or the next 10 years is kind of immaterial to what happens for the next 10,000 years.
Right. I kind of feel like you're the perfect person for the role you're in. And I mean that in the sense that I feel like as you're saying these things, you're not just thinking about how it impacts you, but how to speak to your readers in 3, 5, 10 years and your audience. And I think I would feel a tremendous amount of pressure from that. And responsibility. And I really wonder how I just think you're well suited for it because you've seen the cycles or you have the patience or you have the vision and you're thinking about these. Do you think through how to talk to your readers in 3 years from now?
So we do feel a great sense of responsibility. I mean, every day, like we feel like this is our calling and like the world needs this. And so like, we need to do it. In terms of the pressure, at the end of the day, like we are just being us. We're just following the things that like we believe in and we're doing it our way. And we don't give a fuck what crypto Twitter thinks or the Bitcoin maxi scene thinks or what anyone thinks. And so like, we're going to do it our way with what, you know, feels natural to us. And we want people to come along on the train that we're trying to build, but if they don't want to, that's fine. And if I try to put it on my shoulders to feel, make everyone happy or to like, you know, cater to all these audiences, it probably would feel like a lot of pressure, but we're just doing us and we don't really know how to do anything other than us.
Got it. Well, I'm super excited for the conference. I'd love to hear some more. What was it like having to move the conference to Miami and what kind of atmosphere are we looking at here in terms of, is there going to be more than one like stage for speakers? You guys got so many great speakers. One thing I want to compliment you on, not only, I mean, you have all the headliners you could dream about and some featured guests that you would think would be headliners, but I love some of the choices you've made in some of the other voices that you're giving prominence to at the conference.
Cool. Is there anybody you want to give a shout out to?
Big Mar.
Hell yeah.
I'm very excited. I've already agreed. He's coming on the show in a few weeks, but when you guys announced him as a guest, I thought that was super cool. But really, when you have everyone in the space, I mean, John Vallis, Marty Bent, I think Peter McCormick's hosting it. I'm really excited for Jimmy Song's talk. So
cool. Cool. Yeah. No, I love Lamar. He's a baller. He's a baller. And you know, there are people that you meet that really stick out in your memory of like as special people. And his personality is just like so to the max that like I will always remember him for the rest of my life. I mean, he's just a great guy. So So the conference. I mean, the first off, the vibe. Take a step back. I'll do the mayor first. So Mayor Suarez is an incredible executor and politician. And I have dealt with a lot of politicians. They're almost all bullshit. You know, I'm not going to say that Mayor Suarez isn't being opportunistic. He's definitely being opportunistic, but he's being authentically opportunistic. And he made this conference happen in the city of Miami. And if it was not for Mayor Suarez, we'd still be, you know, twiddling our thumbs trying to find a location. And like, you know, from our perspective, like this is a revolution. And, you know, revolutions don't get paused by pandemics. You know, when the revolution, American Revolution happened, it's not like the founding fathers, you know, the yellow fever was abound and they're like, okay, let's call off the revolution. No, it's like, this is a revolution. And, you know, if people die, people get sick, you know, we're fighting a bigger war. I mean, this is bigger than any one ailment or virus or whatever. And so, you know, we would have, there was nothing that could have stopped us from doing this conference. And, you know, our only challenge is that it got big enough that there was no way we could do it under the radar. So that made our lives a little bit challenging in terms of what types of venues we can use. And, you know, the venues don't want to be shut down. So Mayor Suarez not only, you know, recruited us to bring the conference to Miami, but then he, you know, beat people with a stick to, you know, make everything, every hurdle that got in front of us go away. So he's a total badass. I have massive respect for what he's doing. He's got every mayor in the country jealous with how much publicity he's getting and how many companies he's attracting to Miami. The city of Miami, in my opinion, right now is the freedom capital of the United States. And if you go there on the streets right now, it is like on fire. I mean, people are out, they're about, I mean, the atmosphere is just awesome, high energy. And so I just can't be thankful enough. And we'll have him kind of give some opening remarks to the conference too. And so, yeah, can't say enough. In terms of the vibe of the conference, you know, this is not like your typical business conference. There is a business element to it, but this is more like a festival. And so, you know, we've described this to people as like almost like South by Southwest meets, Money 2020 meets Burning Man. Like it's a fusion of culture, of technology, of business. You know, we have what we're calling our whale pass. So we have our, you know, whales that are all serious and, you know, are rocking like big stacks. And we have like our taco clubs and, you know, just like your everyday Bitcoiner as well. You know, this is probably the only conference where you'll walk around and you'll see, you know, Saudi sheiks, Russian oligarchs, you know, tech venture capitalists, you know, senators, porn stars, rappers, NBA, NFL, you know, late night TV host. You know, I think there's going to be more billionaires per capita at this conference than any conference that's ever been held other than like the World Economic Forum or something like that. So this is going to be a weird fusion of people who share, I think, a intellectual trait of loving freedom. And like getting back to our earlier conversation of like what Bitcoin kind of self-selects the most interesting people who have these shared views. This conference is going to showcase that. I mean, it's like going to have everyone. In terms of the stages, we have three different stages. You know, we're not calling one the main stage or a secondary stage. They're all the main stage. We have one stage that is a presenter focused stage where we're going to have kind of shorter content, one person presenters where we can kind of go through as many interesting ideas or product announcements as possible. You know, we have two stages, one that's primarily, you know, keynotes has a little bit bigger capacity in it, and another stage that is just as important people, but we're going to get into a little bit grittier topics. So like a lot of, you know, the Taproot discussion or, you know, the state of Bitcoin Core or the state of Bitcoin mining, etc. We'll have the agenda coming out in the next week or so. So people will be able to get some color into all the different topics we're covering. Then like around the conference, generally speaking, it's going to be really strange. It's going to be strange in all the best ways. We have you know, a half pipe there that Tony Hawk's going to be skateboarding on. You know, we have sumo wrestlers there that are going to be battling it out. We think that we can maybe bring resolution to the entire taproot debate. We want to make one sumo wrestler represent speedy trials, you know, and the other sumo wrestler represent user activated soft fork. And then whoever wins, Bitcoin Magazine is going to endorse that taproot activation model. All right. So that's a very scientific way for us to get, you know, get taproot going. You know, we're going to have piles of cash, pallets of cash from Venezuela that people can take home with them. I mean, we're going to have synchronized swimming, Cirque du Soleil. We're going to have DJs, graffiti artists, an art gallery, auctions, all sorts of cool stuff, Bitcoin ATMs. Everything's going to be Lightning enabled. You're going to be able to buy your swag, your coffee, your food, all of it. It's all Lightning enabled. It's going to be, I mean, it's like Willy Wonka's factory for Bitcoin. So, and then in terms of the exhibitors, I mean, we have hundreds and we have 1,000+ companies participating in the conference. We have, 150-ish exhibitors, maybe 130 exhibitors. So huge number of exhibitors. Sadly, we've sold out of exhibit space, but I mean, I think people are going to get a huge kind of swath of the Bitcoin ecosystem and get to touch it. We've had a hard rule that you can only sponsor if you're there to promote a Bitcoin product, and you can only promote Bitcoin products at the conference. So, you know, as we've scaled up the event, we've had to define who is a Bitcoin company, what's not a Bitcoin company, you know, what's on topic, what's off topic. Like, and people think it's all clear cut. It's not exactly clear cut. You know, is wrapped Bitcoin a Bitcoin product or not a Bitcoin product? Okay, well, what if your product lets people use wrapped Bitcoin, but it doesn't let people use, you know, Bitcoin? So like we've had to like figure out how to slice and dice all this, but I think we have a great group of exhibitors that people will get to see a lot of new products. We have a startup pitch area where we're going to be doing, you know, VC investments into stuff. So hopefully some new cool ideas. You know, we have a e-gaming area where we're going to have a Lightning enabled competition. I think they even made a version of Tony Hawk Pro Skater where you're going to be able to, you know, play the video game and earn sats. I mean, how cool is that? Mm-hmm. If I would have fun at this event, that was kind of our thesis for how to put it together. And I think people are going to walk away inspired of the cool stuff that they can do with Bitcoin. And they're going to walk away with a bunch of new friends that can become their, you know, future business partners or, you know, future best men or women in their weddings. You know, I hope that the legacy of this conference is felt for the next decade to come.
Right. I really want to ask you in terms of, I'm super excited for the conference. I can't tell you how it's one of those things where I'm so excited where the excitement beforehand is almost insurmountable. And I know it's going to go super quick when I get there. And that's why I'm trying to be very low time preference when I'm there and just go with the flow. And
sure.
I've been to some of those kind of things that you mentioned before where you have a lot of different choices and you can't do it all. And yep. I'm going to try to enjoy being in the moment because I think there's just going to be moments to be had there. And so I'm really excited.
In fact, people aren't going to love this, but the reality is that we have so many people coming. We have capacity issues. Like when you get to a certain size event, it's about not just it's about the flow of people because, you know, frankly, there's not a single room other than there's one building in all of Miami that can have 10,000 people in it simultaneously. So we actually have to schedule things so that there are conflicting things you want to do so that we can manage the flow of people to keep it from turning into like a shit show. So, it's gonna tear people's hearts, not be able to do it all, but that just means come back to Bitcoin 2022.
Exactly. Yep. So I really want to ask you about hyper Bitcoinization.
Yeah.
Not in terms of price, but like, are there ways you think that going through this process is going to change the world around us in ways that many people haven't foreseen or haven't thought about?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, first off, it's interesting to think through the societal effects of moving from an inflationary system to a deflationary system. And what does that mean? And What does it mean when, you know, all people have access to financial markets and therefore to commercial markets globally and can compete on a level playing field everywhere? How many new businesses does that enable to make happen? How many new customers does that create? What new markets does that generate? And the compounding effects of that. What type of educational resources are needed in order to actually be competitive in that market? Because it's clearly not a four-year bachelor degree that's going to make you competitive in a truly global market. It's going to be some sort of consumable internet-based information or content. So what does that look like? We're really kind of building a society that lives outside of or beyond the scope of like people's limited geographical realm. So, you know, like, what does it mean to be a member of a truly global society where everyone has a higher degree of individual sovereignty than they've ever had? What does that world look like? What does it look like when you have developing countries and within 10 years time, the richest people in all of those countries are Bitcoiners? You know, I mean, if you're someone who lives in a third world nation and you have $100 of Bitcoin or $50 in Bitcoin, go 2, 3, 4 bubbles out from now, you're now the richest person in your country. So, you know, there's the concept of he who controls the money controls the world. Okay, well, Bitcoiners control the money now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you're talking about empowering and massively economically rewarding people who believe in a completely different set of ideas than the aristocracy that we have running the world today. What type of impacts does that make? Likewise, you know, from a technology perspective and standpoint, you know, as the price of Bitcoin goes up, the amount of money that's going to be invested into Bitcoin mining rises proportionally. Already, the Bitcoin mining supply chain is affecting the world around us dramatically. You know, the amount of energy being used on Bitcoin mining right now is about 1%, maybe a little bit more. The amount of chip foundry capacity that's being dedicated to making ASIC mining chips is 10 to 15% of the entire global manufacturing capacity of chips. Like that, we're helping cause that quote shortage that is affecting the world. We're driving it in some degrees. And when the price of Bitcoin 10x is again, it's going to make it a lot worse. You know, who wants to make chips for cars or for washing machines when there's a company willing to pay you 10 times more to make it for a mining rig? So, you know, they think the shortage is bad now. Wait until we're eating 50, 60, 70% of the entire chip supply is going to Bitcoin mining. So as the price of those things goes up, the amount of investment into those areas goes up, it's going to basically, you know, the person who makes the most money in Bitcoin mining is going to be the ones that are most effective at solving the limiting agents of the system. So for example, right now, if I want to become a Bitcoin miner, it's not really about having cheap power, though cheap power is a critical thing, but now it's sourcing the hardware. You know, you need the hardware before you can even start talking about having cheap power. Okay, well, how, you know, that means the miners that will make the most money are those that have the ability to get more hardware. Well, what do you need to do to get more hardware? Okay, well, that's going to be the miners that have the best relationships with foundries or maybe own their own foundry. It's going to be the ones that have the best access to silicon. It's going to be the ones that have the best, you know, maybe someone has a new technology that they invent that simplifies the process for manufacturing the hardware rigs. And so, you know, the Cantillon effect that we have now in society that rewards the aristocrats that get closest to the printing press in the Bitcoin system, especially during hyper-Bitcoinization, the Cantillon effect of that system rewards the inventors, the scientists, the people who are manufacturing the machines and the hardware and the electricity in order to be able to mine the Bitcoin. Okay, well, now do that math out. Okay, if Bitcoin goes up, you know, if the next 10 years looks like the previous 10 years for the appreciation of a price of Bitcoin, 10 years from now, the amount of energy, the amount of money being made by Bitcoin mining is going to be several times greater than the entire energy market of the United States. It's it's going to be almost 50% of global energy demand will be dedicated to Bitcoin mining. All right. So that's transformational in of itself. I mean, how many people in America work in the energy markets? Mm-hmm. Millions? 5 million? 10 million?
Right.
Okay. Well, so you're talking about in America in 10 years' time, there could be millions of people whose full-time focus is just on, you know, sourcing hardware, coming up with, you know, building more power plants, building more silicon mines, et cetera. And so this is actually going to cause, in my opinion, an explosion of increased industrial capacity, which then yields all these additional tangential benefits for society. Like, oh, wow, we've come up with a better nuclear reactor because, you know, we were able to make so much money Bitcoin mining. Well, guess what? That nuclear reactor now is good for everything. So I actually see this golden age of technological advancement around the corner that people, I think, discount because we're so pessimistic about the future. But in reality, you know, we're so restrained right now by the system that we live in that once we get rid of those shackles, I think there's going to be an explosion of new science and hard science. I mean, if you wanted to train, like, let's say there's 5 million new people that go into Bitcoin mining in the next 10 years in the United States, okay? How do you even get 5 million engineers? I mean, there's not, the universities don't graduate that many engineers. We're going to have to fix the education system just to be able to source the engineers required to go build the power plants needed to be able to mine the Bitcoin that's out there. And so, like, you know, there might become a point in time where the person who has the best competitive advantage in mining is actually the person who's best able to educate and train new engineers, and that's their competitive advantage in the landscape. And so, like, that trickles, that impact moves through society, and step by step, each part of our economy, which is really just the interactions of people living together in society and collaborating, it fixes, you know, it's like the meme, Bitcoin fixes this, you know, like literally if you can fix the problem, you're going to have a competitive advantage that you can directly monetize to your benefit. And so, wow, that seems so straightforward, but it's, you know, as inflation disguises what our problems are, entrepreneurs spend a whole bunch of time solving for the wrong problems. They're trying to figure out how to get you to click on more ad units on Facebook, mm-hmm. rather than thinking through, you know, how do I build a solar panel that's, you know, 30% cheaper so that I can scale up a massive mining operation to make a shit ton of money. So, you know, I think like these are all unforeseen consequences that are not 100 years in the future. Like everything I just described is if just the next 10 years looks like the last 10 years for Bitcoin.
Right.
That's the only assumption you have to make. And that's what in the 2030s, Epoch 6, that's what's going on.
Do you see this hyper-Bitcoinization as being a very positive experience for the world in the sense that there's no resentment towards Bitcoiners through this and the world recognizes that all these benefits we're talking about? Or do you also see negative pushback, even if it's not founded or informed?
It'll definitely be messy, but, you know, I don't think that there's necessarily going to be, you know, an explosion in Bitcoin and an implosion in fiat. I don't think it necessarily will work like that. I think I could see a reality where it's this concept of abundance, where, you know, one group of society gains immense benefits. Anyone can join that group in society. You just go get some small amount of Bitcoin and hold on to it. And the purchasing power that those people have, it's not that the purchasing power of other people will necessarily disappear overnight. It's that there's a group of people that are going to have so many additional resources that by the very nature of them spending those resources throughout society, they're going to transform what the economy looks like. And so it's almost like, you know, in the 1300s, we were in the Dark Ages. The Catholic Church monopolized information. They monopolized money. We got the printing press, so freedom of information. We got the double entry accounting system, freedom of trust. We combined those two things together. We had corporations, stock markets, international trade. Those tools allow people to become artisans, to become entrepreneurs and business people, and to prosper outside of the domain of the church. I didn't have to become a clergyman anymore to be successful in society and create value. And so you saw an abundance of new businesses, new manufacturers, new technologies to support those manufacturers, and people's quality of life dramatically increased. It's not that the Catholic Church imploded and, you know, there was no Catholic Church anymore and people were like, where do I go? It's just like one way, one path was so much better for the participants that it just outcompeted the other system. And it's not like people were resentful necessarily against the freedom of the free markets that came along and they're like, you know, I wish it was back where the Catholic Church told me what knowledge I need to know. Like, so I think that there's this world where, you know, Bitcoin just keeps doing its thing. The people that get aligned with the Bitcoin economy are going to be rewarded massively. There is no gateway there's no gatekeeping that's going to keep anyone away from becoming a part of that economy if they want to be. And if you do join it, you're going to be welcomed with economic prosperity. And, you know, that's a good sales pitch when, you know, the alternative is keep doing what you're doing now where, you know, you're struggling to get by and the cost of the things that you buy just keeps going up every year. So I don't know. We'll see. I've learned that I don't have the answers to everything and that I'm wrong all the time. So, you know, who knows? But
yeah, I think you're very insightful, though. And I like the way you think about the future and what we're going through. I'm kind of curious at a personal level, you know, you were interested in finance, economics, and entrepreneurialism before Bitcoin. You were interested in markets before Bitcoin. You were interested in like things like microfinance, which not just to be entrepreneurial with that pursuit, but to help others through financial, I don't want to call it products, but like philosophy or opportunity. So, yep. Okay, you know, so in that regard, maybe, you know, Bitcoin to some might just be a tool they find on their way. And then they're like, oh, this is the thing that I was looking for and it can help me do these other things. So has Bitcoin changed you?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and I got very lucky. And I think this is probably the story for all the early Bitcoiners. There's some reason why you're able to get it before other people. And I don't mean it like, oh, I'm smarter than other people are. It's just that I had experiences that made maybe certain hurdles that other people would see and they'd say, you know, they would see the hurdle and think it's not possible to get over, or they don't know the hurdles that exist within the system we live in. You know, I was fortunate to already be exposed to a lot of these ideas. And so I made it took me a month and a half, you know, to jump from Bitcoin's a scam to wait, wow, this could work and this has potential. So, you know, one of those things, I was very into value investing, very into markets. I lost a ton of money when I was in high school. I've made and lost money many times. I made money in high school investing into like Apple stock and Google stock, you know, just because I'm a kid and I didn't know really what I was doing. And I just bought things that
were investing.
I was investing. Yeah.
Yeah. It wasn't like you didn't know what you were doing and you were buying, you know, candy.
Yeah. Well, sure. But, you know, I ended up losing a lot of money in the 08 crisis by buying bank stocks. And, you know, that was kind of my first lesson that the system is a scam and that, you know, when a CEO tells you everything is fine, red alarms should be going off. So, but I was young and naive at this point in time and everything is fine, then it's fine. So losing a bunch of money in the 08 crisis made me actually stumble across Ron Paul. And, you know, I just couldn't understand how did Ron Paul see this? I saw a video of him giving a speech and it was like, how did he see this when supposedly no one else saw this? You go listen to CNBC and, you know, the what you walk away with is that no one could have possibly seen this coming. And so Ron Paul is what gatewayed me into Austrian economics and radical free market economics. And then at the same time, I also did an internship for a man who was one of the pioneers of microfinance and had built a great business around kind of what's called double bottom line or impact investing, where you're making money, but you're also making money and measuring the good consequences of what it does for the world. And microfinance exposed me to how many people didn't have bank accounts, how many people relied on cell phones as the critical infrastructure in their life, how dependent people are on financial products in order to be able to build the foundational building blocks of their financial life. It exposed me to, you know, banks aren't straight evil people. The reason that banks don't service customers in different markets is because they can't do it profitably. And they can't do it profitably because there are certain regulatory restrictions, such as AML, KYC, et cetera, that make it impossible to service someone in Kenya who doesn't have an ID, who, you know, has a few dollars. Like, you just can't do it profitably. And so, you know, banks, if they can make money doing it, they'll do it. So it's, you know, it's... So all of those things kind of set me up to understand that the system that we have right now does not work for the majority of the world. And, you know, we live in America in this like super privileged world when a billion people on the planet make less than a dollar a day, 6 billion people on the planet make less than $10 a day. Make sense of that. You know, like you eat a, you go out for lunch, you can't even spend $10 on lunch. Yet 3/4 of the planet work all day to make $10, and they're supposed to provide for a family off of that. So, you know, being exposed to all these ideas, like, you know, at that time, I was very pessimistic about the world because, you know, these are all problems that we have and there's no clear solution. And then when I saw Bitcoin, it was like, this is a potential possible solution if it can handle all of these different challenges it's going to have. And then, like, as I saw people not only identify the challenges, but also provide potential solutions for the challenges and then build the solutions and then test the solutions and then get customers in the market and then scale those solutions. And then it's like, wow, this is the answer. Like, this is the only way. And so I got really lucky being exposed to all those things, or I probably wouldn't have gotten into Bitcoin until several years later when it was much more mature and I'm not going to say obvious, but at least, you know, didn't require so much creative imagination to see it there.
Yeah. I mean, what I really trying to get from this story and really impacts me is that it's one thing to recognize an idea. It's one thing to be convicted in something. It's another thing to go and embark on a journey. You know, it's, you know, because you could say, oh, this Bitcoin thing, it's a solution, but I'm still going to go get a job after college. And, you know, how much money can I really put in that? It's just, to me, it's really remarkable that when these ideas present themselves, especially at an early age, that people then act on them and see them as meaningful for themselves.
Well, that's also a place of privilege that I have, in the sense of, I didn't have a wife, I didn't have children. You know, those things grow the risk profile of jumping onto something. And I was in a place where it's like the worst case scenario that happens to me is I start back at square one and I'm already at square one.
You also could have went to Europe with the money, you know, and pissed it away in so many different ways. It's really remarkable to me in that regard. And I have a question for you, though, in terms of inflationary money and deflationary money. And like right now, I think of like Bitcoin as my unit of account. And I wonder, like, do you think that makes sense on a permanent basis? In a world where we've adopted a Bitcoin standard, would we still use Bitcoin as a unit of account? In the sense that the way I frame that up is like, I don't think fiat makes sense because, you know, I'll say, oh, Michael Jordan made $30 million 20 years ago. What would that be worth now? What would the equivalent player have to make now? And then you have to reframe the money because there's a new denominator. Mm-hmm. But if the denominator is deflationary, does it or fixed, does it make sense to be used as a unit of account?
So I still think it makes sense to be used as a unit, maybe not Bitcoin, Satoshis at that point in time. But
sure, that's what I mean. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, I think it's hard to use it as a unit of account, obviously, now, because at the end of the day, there is a trading price into fiat currency. And so really people are denominating stuff in dollars or whatever, and then they're converting it into Bitcoin. And so the price is rapidly fluctuating because at the end of the day, they're still counting things in dollars. But when that tie is severed and you can't buy Bitcoin with dollars anymore, then the only unit of measure that we have are Satoshis. And I think that, you know, it does show, you know, what you want to measure is your purchasing power. Like what you're trying to measure is your ability to acquire some asset that has some obtainable value to you. And in a deflationary system where your purchasing power is going up, yes, you know, maybe there, I mean, there's still a change in the value of what a Satoshi buys.
Yeah.
But it's still clearly demonstrating to you how much value of something that you can obtain. So like a good example, Peter Diamandis talks about money or value from the standpoint of time and how much time it took to do certain things. And as time progression goes on and more technology comes about, we get exponentially more units of things accomplished in the same base layers of time, you know? And so it's like in, I'm butchering the explanation here, but yeah, a person today, you know, is a million times more efficient in terms of the amount of work that they can accomplish with the same units of time as someone who lived in ancient Egypt. But that I don't think that that takes away from it being a useful understanding of how much progress has happened between point A and point B. You know, it's like, yeah, it's maybe not apples to apples that a human back then had access to less things, but it is apples to apples that we can understand a person today building upon the shoulders of all the people that came before them has a million times more capacity to accomplish things than people, you know, 10,000 years ago did. So, you know, it's definitely better than a system where we're arbitrarily making it up as we go along based on whatever the political, you know, wind that blows that year, that season, that month.
Yeah. And I guess my final question is, you know, looking forward, is 2025 the year to watch in terms of hyper-Bitcoinization? And I'll loop in there, you know, is that when central banks would be, you know, acquiring Bitcoin in your mind?
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't know. I said in 2018, I put a tweet pinned to the top that I thought maybe 2025 is the year to watch. I think we'll probably end up hearing about central banks buying Bitcoin this year. I think it's already happening. And I think that, you know, things happen slowly than people anticipate and then faster than they expect. And I think that like it's going to go slowly then rapidly. And once central banks start buying it and that's in the public, and the central banks are competing against each other to buy it, the cat is out of the bag, and this could go really fast. But I think what really makes hyper-Bitcoinization occur is when people by large are accepting it or being paid in it, where they're putting their own personal equity behind it. Like, you know, a situation where the central banks of the world own all the Bitcoin, and then they issue a derivative asset on top of it that humans have to, you know, their peasants have to use. That's not hyper-Bitcoinization. Hyper-Bitcoinization is when the people of the world see Bitcoin as value and money for the people of the people. And that's what they want to transact in. That's what they want to be paid in. And that's what they're willing to trade their sweat equity for. And that's going to take time. It's going to take time, but it's an inevitability. We'll get there. And, you know, every podcast episode you make accelerates it that much more.
Yeah. Well, it's been such a pleasure. You guys are putting out tremendous work. I read the articles a lot. A lot of the writers of the articles have been on the show, and as well as some of your, you know, people that are hard work at Bitcoin Magazine, like CK and Joe Rogers and Nick Cammine have all been on the show. You're building quite a team. And, you know, for me, you guys are a beacon, you know, as I think the purest, biggest voice in the space.
You know, I appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah. And so I appreciate the mission you guys are on, and I can't wait to experience Bitcoin 2021 in Miami.
Not the mission that we're on, the mission that we're all on. All right. Correct. You're on the team too here. So, you know, Cedric, thank you for having me on. I look forward to meeting you in person, and to your audience. I look forward to, I hope you make it to Miami. If you can't make it to Miami, watch our live stream, read Bitcoin Magazine, help us change the world.
Yep. Are you still on a Twitter strike, and where can people find you?
I'm still on a Twitter strike for now. You can find me at Bitcoin Magazine. And then I'm making my decision about when I'm going to return to the arena, because there's too much fun in the arena to not come back to it. It kills me every day.
The longer you go, the more I hope you never come back in a way as just some sort of stand. I think it's awesome. So thank you so much. This has been so dope.
David Bailey on the Bitcoin 2021 conference, making Bitcoin great again, and how the Bitcoin revolution will not be stopped by anything, right here on the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. And thank you for listening. If you'd like to sponsor the show or just want to chat about Bitcoin, hit me up. My DMs are always open. Keep your head in the game, keep learning, and keep stacking. Hope to see you all in Miami. This is Cedric. Peace.